So we come to our last our last period of discussion. There's been a lot of talk in the last couple of days, I think. a lot discussed, and I think quite a lot of ground has been covered. In fact, I think very much so a lot of ground has been covered, and very difficult to take it all in. One of my beasts with teachers and people who talk about the Dharma is that when they get up to talk, they can go on for hours and hours. And I've always felt that the longer people talk about practice, the more it really gets sort of diluted and dissipated and more difficult to remember. I always think that maybe sort of about 10 minutes each time is generally quite enough to be going on with until the next time. So I don't know what that says for about 6 hours. but anyway, that's the way it is. I just discovered this piece of paper that I wrote out a few days ago, just putting points down that I, so that I wouldn't forget, so as to try and paint a fairly complete picture in this time that we're together. And I think I've more or less covered everything. There are always bits more, and we can use different words and dwell in different areas, but I think that's the sort of general framework. So I hope it's been useful. I don't really have much more to say on what we've been covering, really. I think it's been pretty much covered. So I just hope that you find it useful, and if you have any further comments or queries on anything really that we've covered, then please feel free.
It's more of a Buddhist type question, which I know you're not that fond of. We didn't mention stream entry or entering the stream over the Latin again. I'm just wondering, is that implied transcendental insight arising, or is stream entry in a way to precede all of that? In stream entry, simply, you've managed to take your basic sort of habits, you know, this emotional drive, and reorientate it towards...
transform it.
Yeah, but so... that's not the same as, say, the Buddha mind awakening. It's not the same as transcendental insight starting to flow. I used to always think it was, but now
well,
it precedes by a long, long time, perhaps.
Well, you know, we are playing with words, and I know there are people who seem to think that anything remotely dharmic is transcendental.
I don't even know what I mean by transcendental.
Well, I don't really either, actually. it's a concept that's thrown around very freely by lots of people. I don't quite know why they do that, whether they think it's just to encourage people, or when you actually begin to think about the Dharma or dharmic understanding begins to come up. That in fact you are actually not contemplating the world, worldly thoughts, normal worldly thoughts, but actually dharmic thoughts. So in that sense, you can say it's transcendental because it's transcending the world, if you like. And that's sort of fair enough. I mean, I think it probably encourages and also helps you to distinguish between worldly thoughts and dharmic thoughts, which is very, very important. It's really... How you wish to define these words. I mean, technically speaking, transcendental means something beyond the ordinary mind, and that's not awakened until stream entry. So what we are really doing throughout the whole of our practice and all that we've been talking about for the last years is that we're preparing the ground for transcendental. For the transcendental, we have to prepare the ground, we have to create the environment for the transcendental to come into being. So what we do in our normal practice is that we are in the world, in the worldly mind, not the dharmic mind, not the transcendental mind, we are in the worldly mind, but we refine the worldly mind through practice. Till it reaches the point where it is barely holding on to itself, barely holding on to its existence. It exists, it grows and it nurtures, it becomes big and strong. When we engage in the world, when we engage in our desires and our aversions, the emotion, the energy that we've been talking about creates that world of immense power, of great depth and breadth and strength. And through dharmic training, the power that creates that world slowly gets transformed until that world becomes less powerful, less broad, less deep, more and more and more. And what was once an all-pervading edifice of ignorance and delusion eventually becomes, through practice, comes like maybe like looking through a window, that the window when you first started was very, very dirty and you couldn't see anything whatsoever on the other side. But through slow polishing and slow cleaning, slowly polishing, we begin to get the ability to see through that window until we reach a point where it really becomes very, very clean. Almost perfectly clean, so we can actually see through it, but not quite. There's that little bit that holds on, hangs on. But this is very much at the end of the training on this shore, as it were, before we cross over to the other shore. And it's all very worldly, and it's always worldly, and it's never truly transcendental. The transcendental takes place when, through polishing that window until it becomes clearer and clearer and clearer, and then finally when we finally polished it for the last time, then we can truly see through it. And when we truly see through it, there is something that is actually beyond that world, something within us that's actually beyond that world, that actually creates the world and is attached to that world. And that which is beyond the world, whether you like to call it the true nature, it has lots of words, at last actually sees through the world that it creates, truly, truly sees through. And when it truly sees through it, it lets it go. And when it lets it go, then it rediscovers itself. And that rediscovery is the transcendental that then awakens. So, technically speaking, we're always in the world of ignorance. We're always in the world of delusion. And even our Dharma practice is actually in the world of ignorance and delusion. But we refine it, everything in degrees, and we refine that. And we learn to nurture. We point ourselves, as it were, into the transcendental, into the real, into reality. Slowly getting closer, slowly nurturing, slowly polishing, bit by bit, until finally it's seen through and it's known. And in that moment of knowing, this is when you would enter the stream, as it's called. Like I say, there are teachers who would call a lot of that path being transcendental. I do know that. But I think in a technical sense that's not correct. But it doesn't matter. It's only a word.
Can you speak a little bit more on the point that you made earlier on in connection with the fact that we practice and we may not achieve what we would like to achieve in this lifetime, but it is worth buying this lifetime? I suppose dealing with being wholehearted and yet not. And not
achieving. Well, when we come to the practice, it's perfectly natural and normal. We come because we have some desire there, we have some self-interest, we actually want to be free, we want to be happy, we want to be something or other. We want to achieve something, and that's perfectly natural and perfectly normal. But it's also a part of the mind that we've had since we were children, since our mind first came into existence, and we learnt. We become aware of this self, of this me, and learn from when we were a baby that if we wanted something, whatever it may be, if we'd done something, then we would get what we wanted, whatever that may be. And we learned from a very early age that practically everything that we do has this self-interest in there somewhere. There's always something in it for me. If I do this, I get that. And we learn this. A baby begins to learn this. When it cries, it gets the attention that it wants, and it soon realizes that if I do this, I will get what I want. And we then spend really the whole of our lives in that state of mind that it's. I think ultimately everything that we do, however refined it may seem at times, there is always self-interest. I think it's just about impossible not to be able to do anything that doesn't have self-interest somewhere. No matter how altruistic we may be and how much we may do something for others and give our lives to others, if we look closely enough, I think we'll always see that there's something there for me somewhere. So it's all self-motivated. And that's really, when we investigate that, is always the cause of the problem. So when we come to the Dharma, of course, that too is coming from that mind. If I practice the Dharma, I will be free of suffering. I will be enlightened. If I do this, I will get that. And it's not only unavoidable, but that's okay, because that's the way we are. But the quality of the Dharma is, as we nurture it and go deeper, that we somehow try, maybe consciously engage and become very aware of that desire that's always there, and learn hopefully eventually to actually drop desires to be what we want to become, that self-image or that. I remember when I first started practice with my Zen, I had two lists in my mind very, very clearly. I had one list here of all the things that I didn't like about myself and that I wanted to get rid of. And I had another list over here of all the things that I wanted to become, all the virtues and, you know, all the great human virtues that we all admire, probably so that everybody would like me. So there were these two sets of desires that were very clear, and I thought, well, that's perfectly all right. You know, that's okay. I don't want to become this. I want to drop all of this, and I want to become that. This is all self-view and self-motive. It's just an ego trip, basically. I think you will learn that when you actually get into this, into the practice, that the way the Dharma works, it doesn't work the way that you want it to work. It doesn't create, it doesn't change the way that you want it to change. When you go into change, it's not the change that you necessarily want, or the priority of I don't want to be like this, I want to be like that. This, as I say, is very much a self-view and a self-desire. And the Dharma itself, when change begins to take place, actually, as we've touched on earlier, doesn't really work the way that we think and the way that we want it to be. It seems as though it actually takes care of itself, and what we actually want out of it is not really particularly interested, actually. And the more that you can begin to get in tune with that, the more ideally you begin to let go of your desire for change, your desire to become something, because you do see that deeper and deeper and become more and more obvious that it's just another self-view, and it's just another ego trip. And eventually, the more that we can open up and become aware of that, we can actually drop the desire to change, drop the desire to become something, and actually do the practice just for the sake of doing the practice. We know that doing the practice is clearly the best thing that we could ever do, and it's really the only thing really worth getting out of bed for in the morning, actually. And just that alone should be the motivation for us to really throw ourselves into the practice and just do the practice just for its own sake. And if we have that faith and that trust in that process, change will take place. And it's one of infinite paradoxes within spirituality, is that when you want change, you won't get it. And when you don't want it, that's when change will come. And it's an incredibly difficult thing, because it takes faith and it takes trust, and it means a letting go and having trust in that natural process, that change will take place. Now the nurturing deeper and deeper of the Dharma, that even if the fruit of that practice doesn't actually manifest in this life, which I think is what you were touching on.
Yes,
Because we want that change. We want the result of our efforts now. We want to be released now. We have to put faith in that, trust in that process, that it doesn't work the way that we want it. But actually, it is very much an ongoing. It is very much an ongoing process that does take an awful. It does. All Buddhism will tell you that it does take. You know, that we practice this for quite a few lifetimes. And how many lifetimes have you practiced to bring yourself here at this moment? and try to have some faith in that and just do your very best. And when the fruit is ripe, it will drop. It doesn't need anything from you. It will happen quite naturally. And it won't happen until it's ripe. And you can't make it ripe because you want it to be ripe. All you can do is to practice as wholeheartedly and as completely as you can. Just for the sake of doing it, really. Ultimately, that may be a difficult thing now, but to work towards that point where you just do it without wanting reward. That does take faith and trust, but it's something that can be nurtured over time. But we do come from that position of self-interest. I'm doing this practice, I want something out of it. But as I say, the paradox of spirituality, once you get into those wants, I'm afraid the Dharma's not interested really in those sort of desires. But this is very much part of the body of the Dharma and of that dharmic mind that we nurture. It is not the worldly mind. The worldly mind goes, shall we say, in one direction, and the dharmic mind goes in the opposite direction. And all of that self-motivating, desiring, however lofty a desire it may be, and this is certainly a very lofty desire, that's still the world. That's still the worldly mind. And that dharmic mind we have to discover, and we have to nurture it, and it's very subtle, and we truly have to engage with it in order to nurture it. But that dharmic mind, on so many different levels, is so different.
Just curious about Shraddha, or faith, because it seems to be key to all of this. It's like, if I'm practicing equanimity, I'm not getting that sort of almost twisted kick out of indulging my negativity, nor am I sort of getting that great buzz out of the more positive experiences. And then if I'm trying to just do the practice for its own sake and not be caught up in goals, it's like I'm kind of left, you know.
Absolutely, absolutely. This is why...
So Shraddha seems to be key. I'm just wondering, where does that come from?
Well, this is it. You know, like I keep saying, you can't just turn this thing on and turn it off whenever it suits you. This whole act of actually doing the practice for the sake of doing it, this is also very much a part of the of what we could call the dharmic mind, and the package of spiritual practice is faith. Now, what does faith mean? I think faith means that we put our trust into something that we don't actually really ever know. If we really know it, it's not really an act of faith, is it? It's something that we actually know. But faith is actually to put our trust into something that we don't know. But we come to the Dharma, we read the Buddha's words, we listen to our teachers, we read the scriptures. Somehow we feel, you know, they talk about things that we don't know. But somehow we feel what they're talking about, what they're pointing to, you can accept as being the real thing. It's not just a big con trick that's actually going on. These people aren't just con men who are just trying to string you along because they get a buzz out of it. But they're actually trying to help you. And they're actually pointing to something that they themselves have actually discovered, and they're trying to present that understanding to you, but you don't know it, and you can't relate to it because you never experienced it. So it's something beyond you. But somehow you got to have trust in them. I'm very much very much of the view that if you're not capable of having faith, if everything in your life, everything that you do in your life, you first of all got to work it out beforehand. You want to know, I will do this when I understand what I'm doing. If you are that, if you are that type of mind where you are not capable of faith, are not capable of trust, I don't think you can do this practice. Because this is not a practice of the head. This is not a practice of the logic and of the intellect. There is something else that's beyond that, that we can't grasp, we can't know. And I think it's in that area where this whole area of faith and trust actually is. And we call upon that trust and we call upon that faith at times when maybe in the training we do get lost. We just don't know what we're doing anymore. And we think, what am I doing this for? You know, this doesn't work and I don't understand it. And all the props and all the things that we've set up around ourselves to support ourselves all just fall away. And what are we left with? I think the only thing that we are then left with is faith. And somehow that faith has to be strong enough to give us a buoyancy to carry us until such time as we pass through that difficult period, and we can then begin to find our feet again, and then we can launch ourselves back much more into the practice. That, you see, that goes beyond just thinking and say, oh, I've got faith. It has to then become alive. It has to be something that actually becomes living within you, and a buoyancy that actually supports you, not just a thought, I've got faith. And I mean, I can point to something like that in my own training. Very soon after I started Zen practice, very quickly, a few months I guess, just this incredible blackness descended on me that just stayed with me 24 hours a day. And I just didn't know what's this Buddhist practice, what am I doing, what on earth is all, I mean, I was perfectly all right until I started this business, now look at me. And there was nothing there for me to sort of hold on to and to support me, except I had this, from the moment I met my teacher, I had this faith and trust. And I don't know why, I just did. There was nothing, you know, there was nothing sort of logical about that. I just trusted this person who I met, that they knew what they were talking about, they knew what they were doing. And I surrendered myself to that person, to that trust. And my difficult times, that was all I had. That was all I had, was that faith. There was absolutely nothing else that was faith in my teacher. And that was the thing that kept me afloat, the thing that kept me going until such time as that darkness lifted, and I could begin to see again and get back on my feet, so to speak.
But what would you have meant by kept going? So you have these periods. I think there were five months or so.
I had periods of, yeah, I suppose you call them depression. But just like a dark cloud that was there.
So, how would you describe keeping going?
Well, in the sense of staying with the practice, staying with my job, because that was, could have easily been a part of, I could have easily have made that a part of the depression, because I was having a very difficult time. Just bearing with it, staying with it. Just having that faith to stay with it and not to try to run away from it or try to do something with it or change my job or, you know, whatever, but just stay in that daily routine, just kept going. And it was only faith that managed to keep me going. If I hadn't had a teacher, if I hadn't been doing the practice, well, I would have been gone. I wouldn't have been there a week. I absolutely guarantee it would never. I would never have been able to have stayed with it. but it was faith. And that more than at any other time, it's been needed on several occasions, I would say. But that possibly was the most important, because I had no background, no experience, nothing to hold on to, as it were, within the practice. I was completely new. But somehow I had that faith, and that's what it was. And I think it's one of the qualities of spiritual practice that we need to have, because there are times when that's all we do have, and somehow we got to put our trust in that. And if we are that type of person where I will surrender myself to you completely, providing I know exactly what I'm doing and what you're doing, and you explain everything to me first so I can actually think it all through, and so I can prove to myself, when I do all that, then I'm yours, I'll do anything for you. That's a different... That's not a spiritual mind, that's not a dharmic mind. Somehow there's got to be a faith there, a trust into something that you don't understand.
Well, it sounds like, from what you're saying, I mean, I feel pretty lucky, yeah, because I am in the former camp, basically. But I meet lots of other people who aren't, and my understanding today was that was a perfectly valid way of going about things. I mean, I've never felt quite comfortable with it myself. You know, that you have to kind of... You know, it's a valid way of going about things, if you break things down, check things out.
To a degree. We'll do that to a degree, but there'll come a point when all of that will desert you. What happens then when you can't break things down? When you come up against a brick wall and you can't think your way through it? And you can't see beyond it? You can't sort of project somehow, if I keep doing this, this and this and this will happen? Just thinking it logically through. What happens when you come to that and you think, well, I can't, I don't know, I've lost it, I can't work it out anymore, I can't, I've come up against a wall. If you don't have faith, that's when you'll pack up. That's when you'll say to yourself, this is not working, this isn't for me, I'll go somewhere else, or I'll pack up altogether. This spirituality is a big contract. All of those things, and you'll move away from what you're doing in some way. But if you've got that faith on top of that, investigate. We can't avoid that, and there's nothing wrong with that. But that's very limited. When you're going into yourself and you're going into the unknown, you can't possibly know the unknown by definition. So when you get to that gate, so to speak, where you're about to go into the unknown, and you have no experience, nothing behind you, so you can project and say it's going to be like this, this and this, that's where your faith comes, because you don't know. And when you don't know, you become very frightened. Fear comes. And we all fear the unknown. And so... gosh, I'm not going to do this. This doesn't work. Or if something comes up unpleasant, like my depression, if you like. It wasn't a monster, but it was still very, very unpleasant. Not having anything to do with this. I don't understand this. I don't know what's going on here. If you've arrived at that point with this sort of logical thinking sort of approach, spirit, if you like, that's when it deserts you. That's when you've had it. That's when you'll pack up. But if you've come to that point, of course you investigate. We've been talking about investigation. We have to investigate. But it's within a framework of you know, the spiritual framework. A characteristic of the spiritual framework is that faith and trust. We have to trust. Trust the Dharma. Trust that what we read. We don't know it because we've never experienced it. But we look at it and it feels right. Yes, this seemed like the real thing, the right thing for me to be doing. Put trust in that. Really, trust means to hand yourself into that. And when you come to those very, very difficult impasses, when you're looking over the cliff, into the abyss, into the blackness, bow your head and put your trust in that and move into it. and you will be surprised if your faith is true and you stay with it. That's when you, you know, to me this is the journey. This is where the journey really starts, when you go beyond your mind, when you put your mind to one side and you learn to put your faith into and trust.
David, you mentioned bowing as a practice in the book. Is that very much connected with the book?
Very much so. I mean, this is something we didn't actually touch upon, and again, it's something that can be incredibly expansive. But the bowing is very much, you could say it's very symbolic of what we're actually doing. To bow the head is a symbolic gesture, if you like, of actually giving yourself up, which is what we do in Dharma training, in spiritual training. This is very much a nurturing of the Dharma mind, which is a giving of the self up, the self-motivating thing that we were touching on just now. It's about giving all of that up. And, you know, that mind is immensely complicated. It has just many, many different levels and stratas, and as we've discussed, it can be extremely clever and subtle and throw us off into diversions very, very easily. The act of bowing actually is symbolic, but it's as symbolic as what you want to make it. You can be as ritualistic or symbolic as, or you can actually make it something very real and really do see it as a gesture of an act of actually giving yourself up, of actually giving up the whole of yourself, not bits and pieces, but the totality of yourself. And I know for me that it's always been something very, very useful for me personally. Other people don't take to it so easily, but I've never seen it as a sort of a ritual, some sort of, you know, mumbo jumbo Eastern silly thing that people do in the East, because I'm much more logical and clever and I don't do things like that. I've always taken it as to be the opportunity to just pause for a few seconds and really gather myself up and actually really remind myself what I'm actually doing here. What am I actually really doing? Because we can get lost in such a maze of thoughts. What am I actually really doing here? I'm actually really giving myself up, the whole of myself, the totality of myself. And in that bowing, this is where I remind myself, this is where I bring myself back to the sort of very basis of the whole of spiritual practice, which is to give yourself up. I mean, I do personally take that just a little bit farther, and maybe I say to myself, well, what are you giving it up to, if you're giving it up? And for me, then I can then reflect on that which is beyond me, that which is beyond the self, which is beyond David, which is beyond this world, this world of greed, hatred, and delusion. However you want to describe it, that thing that I'm entrapped by, bound by, like I'm a plaything of something. But again, my faith. I'm from my own experience, I do know. But if I didn't before that became a reality for me, I did have a faith that there was something beyond me, something beyond David, something that was untouched by any of this, something that was the real me, that something that was beyond this world of attachment, that's actually eternal, that actually doesn't exist in time and space, that doesn't actually get caught in birth and death and suffering, something that's actually beyond all of that. Now that's about as esoteric as it gets, if you like, but I've actually never had a problem with that concept, that idea, if you like. And you can very much learn to nurture that spirit and that faith in that within your practice, and bowing helps that enormously. Just in those moments, however illogical it may seem, however daft, just actually gather yourself up and just really commune with yourself, really come back with yourself, beyond your thinking, beyond your thoughts and concepts. Truly gather that up and hand it all back into that which you don't actually know. And you'll never will know. Even when you become it, you still won't know it. And that, to me, we are really getting at the essence of spirituality. And it is about giving this whole sense of me up in that totality. And it isn't the self will convince us that if I give myself up, then there's just a blackness, a void, I'm dying, I'm going to die. And this is how it exploits the whole aspect of fear. If I'm not here, what's going to be here? I'm going to be dead, I'm going to fall over into a chasm. But actually, if you, as it were, call its bluff and actually just stay with that and not be fazed by that fear, actually stay with it, you will make the most wonderful, marvellous discovery that's way beyond your mind, way beyond your understanding and beyond your comprehension. And a part of that discovery is that this is the real you. And all the time you've been stuck in jail. All of your life you've been behind bars, and while you've been behind bars you've been thinking, oh, this is really great. This is how daft we are. And you think, oh, this is all right. And then you discover that all of your life you've been in jail, and you just get that taste, a glimpse, a taste, maybe you truly realise it, that in fact this isn't the real you at all. The real you is beyond all of that. It is truly eternal, and it's full of love, compassion, wisdom. It never born, it never dies. And it's there waiting for all of us to rediscover, and that's truly our true nature. And that can only be discovered, rediscovered through spiritual practice. And spiritual practice is about giving yourself up, the whole of yourself, in totality, little by little, nurturing that ability to really hand yourself over. This goes beyond the logic. This is, me talking like this can mean whatever it can mean to you, but it could also help to give you faith in that which you will never know. And it's an inspiration, and it's a buoyancy, and it can help support and carry you. And this is the whole nature, the whole spirit of spirituality. It's not logical. It's not something you can work out. There's something you can go so far with that, but there's something beyond that where you just you sort of feel your way more. It's in an intuitive practice, but it's full of understanding and light and energy. That if you stay with it and nurture it deeper and deeper, you will realize, it's a guarantee. If you follow it correctly, if you follow the path correctly and nurture it wholeheartedly and consistently, it's a guarantee. You will rediscover your true potential, your true nature, which is beyond all of this. But that takes faith. And if you don't have that faith, I really think you're on a very limited path, limited journey. So the more that you can nurture it and open up to it, open to it, and take it on board and let it become a part of you, the more true your practice will be.
And it's just where the idea of going for refuge comes into the picture then.
Absolutely.
That you're going for refuge to this.
Absolutely. You've hit it right on the head. This is just another way of expressing going for refuge, the real going for refuge.
Well, it's kind of a funny one, because it's like you're embracing uncertainty and all of that, but the word refuge seems to imply the opposite. At least to me, I used to think of refuge as being shelter.
Yes, that's a slightly unfortunate word, I think.
I'm finding that
it's connotation.
It's like, you know, it's continually opening up to.
Yeah, that's right.
Uncertainty.
It is. You know, the going for refuge works on, and as we all know, this is the absolute major principle within the movement, and it's not just within the movement, it's within Dharma practice. It's just that it happens to be highlighted in this movement, but all Dharma practice, that's the central part of all Dharmic training, is the going for refuge. You may not use those I never used those concepts until I came to this movement. This is probably why I've not mentioned them up to now, because I'm not really conditioned into using those words. But the whole of what we've been saying for the last 2 days is about going for refuge. It's about nothing else. And now we're talking in these terms now, getting sort of more esoteric, if you like, here at the end. You know, this really does become much more the real going for refuge. As we work through the thinking and the thoughts and the logic, and all the time nurturing that spirit of actually going for refuge, of going deeper, of understanding, maybe intellectually at the beginning, but slowly going beyond that, into that really living wholeheartedly in life, and putting our trust into something deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. We'll never actually ever get to the end of going for refuge, because it is not a thing. It doesn't have a base or a wall. It's infinity, ultimately. And the whole of the practice, the framework of Dharma practice, is going for refuge. Nothing else but. And within that framework of going for refuge, we do all these little bits and pieces that we play with, but these are all skillful means. These are all little ways that we learn, dharmic ways of nurturing our going for refuge, of going deeper and deeper and deeper, of really giving ourselves up, giving this thing up that wants to control, of giving that up more and more, and putting our trust into something that we don't know. But we have faith and we have trust in that. That actually it's all right, and actually I'm not going to die. Actually, if I really stick to this, this whole thing would just open out into the most indescribable wonder. This is going for refuge, and it's where we can start off with the Buddha and the Dhamma and the Sangha, these three jewels. We conceptualize them. And we separate them. But the more we go for refuge to those three things, the more they will come together, the more they will begin to merge, until those three jewels become one jewel. And that's when you'll enter the stream. And this is a very good thing to take away with you, because I think this is I don't. We really get to the heart of it. And this is where all the note taking finishes, you see. And this is the essence of the going for refuge. When you really are going for refuge, you can't make notes.
See, I'm trying to pull something together. I remember, you know how you can sometimes sort of go in and ask yourself a question, and it's almost like your body gives an answer.
Mm-hmm.
This experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I did this once after, I think, a prostration practice, and I just said, what am I at here? Prostrating before this image or whatever. And I went in, and the answer came back, well, I'm prostrating myself to wisdom. And I thought, well, what's wisdom? And the answer came back, what will be, will be. It's almost like a piece. And so I'm left with this, what will be, will be. In some way, opening up to the fact that there's nothing I can do and I don't really know a lot. But on the other hand, that seems like just complacency as well. I don't know, I don't have an answer here. It's like just trying to... It seems like there's something in that, what will be, and just opening up and accepting it. But
it's faith again.
It's like, maybe it's faith again, I don't know. This is, it's like, I guess.
Faith, you said.
Faith.
Learn to put your trust and faith into something that is illogical, that is beyond you, that you can't work out with a pencil, you can't work out logically. More and more and more. More and more. No, this is all part of the path, part of the journey. But I say the more you go, the more you nurture this, the more you see that you're actually on a spiritual path. You're not on a logical path, and you learn to commune with something that's actually beyond that logic. And that's what you put your faith in. And if you put your faith in it will actually carry you. It will actually carry you in your life. It will actually point the way. And it will support you. And it's completely illogical.
This requires wholehearted. I mean, it seems to be wholehearted as a plus play, but then, otherwise it is complacency. So where do you fit in the sense of, I presume you're about to join the order,
mm-hmm.
with all the study that there seems to be, for me, like, there's a lot of study within the order.
And I'm engaging in it.
Well, how do you find it?
So tell me about it.
How do you find it?
Well, I personally find it, on the whole, I find it very interesting, and it's certainly very educational, and it's helping me to understand and orientate me actually into the mentality of the order. But at the same time, I don't get caught by it. You see, I do take it as a way of actually clearly nurturing my understanding of the, and it dharmically it helps somewhat also. And it is very, very useful, but I do try to see it as concepts, as not the real thing, however deep it may appear and is on its level, but it's not the real Dharma. And I really make sure, I keep checking myself, that I don't get totally attached to it and take it to be this is it, because it isn't it, it's a pointer. And I think if you go into it with that clarity of mind, then actually it is an upaya, it is a help, it's an orientator, it's a clarifier. But ultimately you've got to let it go and not get hung up on it. Whoever says it, not to get hung up on it, and to let it go and actually go beyond all of those thoughts and concepts and ideas. And that's the big danger, is that we do get attached to the written word and the words that people speak. And we must be very, very careful with that. But there is an awful lot of this in the movement. But you have to also take on board that it's something very, very new, and something that's actually being created. Maybe in 100 years' time or whatever, there won't be half this sort of stuff going on, because it will have actually become the movement. But at this point in time, there is a lot of stuff that we all have to. I mean, Buddhism isn't in our culture. That the Dharmic sort of mentality isn't a part of our culture. You come from a completely different culture, and it all has to be learned. So it's all justified in many respects, but don't get attached to it. And think, you know, this is it.
Where does compassion sit with this that we have? Mindfulness and being aware.
Well, as I've touched on quite a few times, the making friends with ourselves and the learning to accept ourselves the way that we are is very much an aspect of compassion. Compassion for ourselves. But then you'll find as you go deeper with the practice that you'll begin to see that what you first of all consider to be quite a space between you, yourself and other people and your relationships with other people, actually that gap, that space becomes very, very blurred. And until you actually really do come to the realization actually that you and other people aren't separate at all. You and your consciousness and your relationship with yourself actually is no different with yourself and with other people. And that compassion that you have for yourself should actually then flow outwards to other people, because it is all one. And compassion works in many, many ways. It's not, you know, just all sort of lovey-dovey. I mean, it can work in very subtle ways and in very helpful ways, different ways. But it is the natural state of the human heart, and the more free from the sense of self that the human heart is, the more it will express that compassion, because that is its natural state. Compassion, again, like all of this, is not something that's manufactured. It's something that's discovered. We all have it. We all have that compassion and that wisdom. But we've lost it, and we have to rediscover it. We don't make it, rediscover it. So the compassion is a natural flowing of the heart, and like I say, it does express itself in many ways. It's not all sort of Oxfam stuff, going out saving the starving and stuff. We too also need to be saved. So it works in many different ways.
Could we say that developing compassion for ourselves, befriending ourselves, is in a way drawing closer to ourselves?
Yeah.
And in that way we are drawing ourselves closer to other
people. Yeah. Well, you will discover, if you don't already know, the more you actually get to understand yourself and see yourself and what you are made of, what makes you up, what makes this whole thing up, you will see that you are a very, very, very large part of you is actually other people and your relationship with other people. Now they may be over there, some I'm here and they're over there, but the more you get to understand yourself, that duality that we imagine it to be actually comes together. And so that in the end you see that yourself, that yourself and other are one. So when you have tolerance and compassion and consideration for yourself, you will naturally have it for other people. You can't split the two, because they're not two. It all becomes one. And when you know yourself, when you truly know yourself, you will know everybody.
Can you combine, sort of say, all of this approach, say you have some vision, you know, reading whatever that this guy said he wants to set up all of these templates, you know, and have full description of all of them. You might have a vision that you want to help a lot of people in another country. You can just do them both together. Is the point that you're making is that regardless of what you do, what comes first is everything you've said about your relationship with yourself. You must be doing that.
The nature of the Dharma is, and the nature of wisdom is, that your compassion comes through understanding of yourself, and it's an ultimate going beyond yourself. Where that true unmotivated compassion comes from, and that can only come through understanding yourself. So, you know, this whole, very often this misunderstood thing about bodhisattvas who just go out into the world to save other beings and they don't think of themselves, is false. Bodhisattvas go out in the world to save other people, but they do it through themselves. They go like this. Out. They don't just go out and ignore themselves. They come into themselves, understand themselves, and that then naturally flows out. And that's more real, genuine understanding, wisdom. Is that what you were?
I think so. Yeah. I think an example from my own life. You know, doing this work. You know, because we were in competition with Oxfam, but joke. sort of. but the, you know, so I felt doing that was a good thing to do.
Yeah.
But I'm not putting my faith. I guess what I'm saying is, you seem to be saying that a lot of people seem to put the cart before the horse. Yeah. So what I'm understanding is that you should do all of what you've said. But the next question I'm asking is that will you still choose a context to do it in? Some people are gardeners, you know. Some people.
Yes, we're all different.
So, but there's something else I'm wondering. Yeah, that somehow something in me thinks that you kind of have some kind of vision of whatever it might be. Yeah, and when you become a transcendental being, yeah, that's flavored somehow by the initial vision that you have. I mean, whatever you dream of, that kind of happens, yeah? So sometimes I think, well,
I doubt it.
It doesn't happen.
I would think that would be, that, like a lot of other things, would be something that would very much go into change over the years. And I think you end up, if you talk about vision and motivations and stuff, I think time you get to the other end, so to speak, I think that would have gone into very serious change.
Yeah.
Almost certainly.
I get that now, because
it's really getting to know yourself to find out what you really want.
Yeah, well, it will take care of itself, actually.
Right. Okay.
It would very much take care of itself. So, it looks like tea time, so maybe That's it. So,
thank you, David, for a wonderful 2 days.
It's very good.
Very easy. Enjoyed.
Well, I enjoyed it too. I didn't think I was capable of speaking for so long. absolutely unbelievable. Amazing. Anyway, I've enjoyed it thoroughly. So thank you for inviting me. Very much, sir.
Again.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Thank you.
Do you know where we are?